And now Iowa Contemporary Art presents ICON Art Radio.
This is ICON Art Radio with Alan Cobb, Donna Colby, and myself, Bill Teeple. Last week we got into an interesting area that Donna brought up. It had to do with performance of action and the different ways that people are able to strike a balance and be creative and find fulfillment and success in their activities. I'm going to pass the ball today off to Alan, who is going to get this started today.
Well, it's an interesting point because it came up in the context of what's a good approach to being productive, whether as an artist or in life in general. To make a schedule and try and stick to it and prioritize your time and have a plan and so forth, or to just set aside a period now and then where you kind of lay yourself open for the muse to attack in whatever way she feels is appropriate at the time. For a while we were saying that, well, they kind of both approaches are necessary because one of them helps keep the channel open, if nothing else, keeps your sword hand agile. And the other approach is that you do have to be open to the muse and not get in her way and so forth. So if you regiment yourself too much, that might not happen. But then we ended up talking about authorship of action, talking about the fact that for some of us, thinking about what you're going to do can be a dangerous thing to do, or at least a counterproductive thing to do, because unless you're thinking about which paints you're going to buy when you get to the store or something very practical, if you're thinking about why am I doing this, or what's the point of doing this, or is this thing that I'm considering doing worth the energy of doing, or is it going to have the value to society and you know, my life and what I'm learning from my life to justify doing it, or is it really just an arbitrary thing that has no particular value at all? That approach, and it's even just an angle of view, it's not an inner dialogue, it doesn't have to be as intellectual as what I just described. It's just, if you glance at an impending action from that vantage point, in the case of lots of people, you end up not doing it. You end up just sort of getting caught onto this divergent path of mental energy that, whether it comes across inside as a mental exploration or a long thought process or just a smack yourself in the forehead moment of total puzzlement, it still can leave you stuck. And that's kind of what happens with me. If I'm about to do something and I start thinking about why I'm doing it or whether it deserves to be done or something like that, I very quickly find myself confronted with a question that's much bigger than what I was about to do and which has no apparent answer, which I have thought about too many times over the years and have never gotten anywhere. And so it becomes, in a sense, more and more important, even though it becomes more and more fruitless. So it's sort of a trap.
So what's that question, the bottom line question that you get to that's the big
dilemma?
The ultimate
bottom line question is, who is performing this action?
And why does that matter to you so much?
That's part of the question, you know,
I mean,
that immediately
very,
raises that question.
I'm familiar with this territory. What's interesting to me is that you're not familiar.
Well, it's just never been, I've never been in that place where that dilemma seemed really significant to me.
Well, I can tell you why it's relevant. It's because if the action you're about to perform is, let's say, counterproductive, like if I find myself heading for the icebox to have a pint of Ben and Jerry's ice cream, mm-hmm. that's something that one clear voice in my head says is not such a hot idea. I would be better off at the end of the day if I didn't do it. But the thought has already come and the action has already begun. And then I'm faced with the possibility of stopping the action, which is another action. And so I think, okay, don't go to the icebox. Well, I'm still going to the icebox. Having the thought, don't go to the icebox, didn't seem to do anything. So I think it again. I think, don't, stop, wait, hold it, stop. And I continue going to the icebox. As I take the ice cream container out of the icebox and put it on the counter, there's this voice in my head saying, this is a really bad idea. Don't do that. That's really stupid. You need to lose weight. It'll fill your arteries with fat. That's a bad idea. Don't eat so much sugar. And while I'm having those thoughts, the lid is coming off of the ice cream container. The spoon is coming out of the drawer. And the question comes to mind, who is telling me not to? And who is getting the ice cream? There, it's as though there were two people there.
It's the little, you've seen it in all the cartoons. It's the little angel and the devil sitting that's on right. your shoulder.
That's right.
And so, oh, well, that clarifies it. We can stop now.
Come on.
Okay. Everybody next knows week, that. We're going to talk about why we're here. Why? Obviously, we're here to give the little devil and the little angel something to ride on.
So, okay, this comes back to a point that we got to towards the end of last week's show as well. Are we mainly, when we're doing something, anything in life, are we generating it and creating it ourselves, or are, in terms of like controlling what we do and what happens, or are we simply responding to something, you know, we're just like riding a log along a river and we can't help it. In the example of your ice cream, it sounds more like that experience was just that, well, nothing you could do about it. You were going to eat that ice cream anyway, and there was no way you were going to be able to stop it.
Well, but you were saying, what would make this question relevant? And mm-hmm. I'm saying, that's a situation. It's sort of a life and death situation on a tiny mm-hmm. scale, and that makes it relevant. So I end up going away from that experience with this lingering uncertainty about, you know, who's driving the car. And as you just said, maybe the action just performs itself. You know, maybe if I could get out of the way entirely, I wouldn't have that dialogue. But another possibility is that maybe if I get out of the way entirely, there will still be a dialogue. I just won't care. I just won't mind the dialogue, and whatever action takes place will take place. And in fact, the action that takes place may itself have nothing to do with the dialogue. It may be that no one is driving the car. But these are, you know, horrendously abstract Advaita kinds of questions that we don't have answers for. And in my level of consciousness, they are spectacularly paradoxical things to think about. And my mind loves them as, you know, mind candy. To think about, and I can think about them deliberately, like we're doing now, you know, till the cows come home. But I can tell you from many experiences doing this with many erudite, insightful, intelligent people that it never gets anywhere. There's like no answer to these questions. Not that they shouldn't be asked necessarily, but maybe good advice is that ask the question and then go ahead with whatever it was you were doing.
That's why
sets up the right platform to function on. It's
I think it's kind of
like the purpose of meditation. Mm-hmm. You're creating a platform. Once you've established the platform from where you're moving from or mm-hmm. acting from, it's 180 degree difference into what you were doing before and after. So by raising the question, setting the stage, and then letting go and performing action, that action now is actually celebrating life, it's life's reason.
Yeah.
But before that, it was like almost had no purpose. I mean, it's really an interesting.
Yeah, because you can dismantle every, you know, that's why Socrates got in so much trouble, because of continually pulling out the rug out from under anything,
people.
You know. And in early Greek democracy, Solon, is that how you pronounce his name? Solon. He made a rule, when he was establishing all of his rules that he put on this like wooden tablet that everybody could read, one of the rules was you had to have, on every issue, every citizen of Athens had to have an opinion. Because, and if you didn't have, take sides, take a stand one way or the other, you couldn't be a citizen. Because it wouldn't work if you just were kind of a whatever sort of a person. And I found that really fascinating because much of my life, I haven't taken sides.
No, I'd be in deep doo-doo.
I've seen things from many vantage points and chosen, you know, to, well, yeah, it's this. On the other hand, there's this. And when I read that, I thought, God, I can see that. Because for a whole society to function, you couldn't have everybody be just going all over the place. You know, you have to make you have to take some kind of a chosen direction.
Well, the thing that comes to mind in dealing with this issue is what I think is the most important thing anyone could ever learn about the intellect. And I use the word intellect advisedly. We don't really have a good term for what is sometimes referred to as ritam, which is a very subtle aspect of intellect. When I say intellect, I mean the rational, analyzing, verbal capacity that seems to be at the basis of all of the mental dialogue that goes on, whether we want it or not. Certainly this discussion that we're having is by necessity more intellectual than anything else. But the thing that people don't get about the intellect, about this faculty, and the thing that's never taught about it, and the thing that would save a lot of pain and sorrow in life, I think, is the knowledge that the intellect does not answer questions. Its role is to ask the questions, or if you will, to define the object of inquiry, but it hasn't the capacity to answer them. You don't think about something and then reason together an answer. What happens in reality is you think at something, and then you forget about it, and you wake up in the middle of the night with the answer. Or the next time you think about it, you find that the answer has been there for the last 3 days and you didn't notice it. Or you discover that the answer was there all along. Or while you're framing the question, you realize, oh, that's actually not a question. I already know the answer. But if we could somehow just get comfortable with the idea that answers have to do with perception, not analysis. Analysis is the process of taking things apart to see how they work or how they're built. But answers come from the heart. They come from intuition. They come from a holistic kind of perception of the object of inquiry. So the intellect can be useful for separating the object of inquiry from everything else. I'm talking about decision making. So now I know. And the question is, you know, who makes the decision? And the answer is, you won't find it by thinking about it anymore. It's great that you thought about it this much because now you know what your question is.
So by this model, analysis is just another way to refine the question.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't generate answers, and the answers won't come from the muscle that you use to ask the question. There's another muscle, which unfortunately is not one that gets used by you. It's one that simply does whatever it does, and we sort of know that we have no control over it. Where there's this illusion of control over the thinking thing, there's no illusion of controlling the feeling thing. It's just we feel what we feel, and I think intuition is a feeling function, not a thinking function. So this thing about, you know, when I think about what I'm going to do before I do it in any kind of abstract way and it leaves me paralyzed, the solution that I'm sort of learning and practicing more and more is to not expect an answer from thinking about it, and in a sense not need an answer to the question. I need to express the question. Having expressed it, I can be done with the mind thing, and then let the heart take over, and that puts me right back in action, because the heart will say, well, I'm getting up and doing whatever it is that I'm doing.
So why do people want answers? Like, what, I mean, I don't really think I've ever thought in terms of answers. It's more of decision, you know. It's like I'm thinking about, if I'm thinking about something, or if an issue is presenting itself to me, it has to do with what choice am I going to make and what direction am I going to go in. So I'm curious to know what you actually mean in this context by an answer. Like, what do people
I think people think get puzzled or troubled or confused by the things they think about. And so if you're thinking about, why can't I control my behavior? Why can't I control my diet, for example, which is an addictive behavior and nobody has much control over it. Mm-hmm. And you say, well, what do I do? Well, how can I improve my performance? I'm just gaining weight and I've got to lose weight. What on earth could I possibly do? And people will tell you things like, well, you should get more exercise or you should eat less. And this is like, you know, telling someone who that they should breathe. Of course I should get more activity and eat less. My problem isn't knowing whether or not I should do that. My problem is in knowing where the button is or the lever that causes those things to take place. And it gets right back into this, you know, weird sort of esoteric question about who's performing the action. Because if you talk to anybody who's trying to quit smoking, they'll tell you, I'm determined not to smoke, but I just have to have a cigarette. And you can analyze that on any level you want, but inside, you know, it's right. Just that one thing of, well, who's doing it? Who's lighting the damn cigarette while at the same time saying I shouldn't be doing this?
Which is why people can go to one seminar after another, read yes. one book after another yes. with advice in all the different categories of life and
get nowhere.
Wind up with the same problem. Even though, usually when we hear something new, some new angle on whatever our situation is, it can spark us for a while, just mm-hmm. because it's probably because it does something on an emotional level that feels inspiring. It gives us hope.
Right.
And then we open ourselves up to thinking differently than we've been. We're not so stuck. And so we're opening the door then for these moments that you were describing where we wake up one morning and we see the light and we know, oh, today, you know, we feel like doing something different.
Yeah. Well, two years ago, I suddenly found myself being able to see the real underlying reason why I was eating food between meals and wanting to eat, you know, whole, you know, containers of ice cream for dessert. And I saw that eating between meals and eating the ice cream was not an actual way of fulfilling that underlying desire. And so I saw the behavior as being unconnected with satisfying the underlying desire, and I simply stopped eating between meals. And I stopped eating ice cream.
What was the underlying desire?
It's not something that's describable. It was very subtle. But I could just see how there wasn't really a connection between the eating and the fulfillment that I sought. And I lost 65 pounds in 6 months. And there was almost no effort involved. There were a few occasions where I had lost 30 or 40 pounds and I suddenly had this incredible urge to, you know, go on a binge or something. And I just stopped myself almost by using my hands to grab the rest of my body and shake it or something. It's hard to describe. But, I did just kind of use a monumental amount of inner force to say, no, no, I won't, I won't, I won't. And for a couple of minutes, you know, it was like a real battle going on as I stood without moving in the middle of the kitchen, headed for the icebox. And I ended up not doing it and continued losing weight and continued, you know, till I'd lost about 65 pounds. And 99.9% of the time, there was no effort. There was no thinking about it. It was just, I'd think, boy, I'd love to have a Coke now. And at the same time, I'd think, but that's not going to make me feel any better, so I won't. And then that winter, I could feel something shift. It was like a layer of fog came in, very thin, And I couldn't see under the desire for food anymore to whatever it was motivating it. And I just began eating a little more and a little more, and I've been doing that ever since.
So why do you think it is that some people have kind of get stuck in this situation of having knowledge and information that, you know, I shouldn't do this, and just doing it, and other people seem to, or even have this philosophical dilemma that you've been describing, where you're kind of paralyzed in one way or another. And there are other people who are just kind of action people, and who probably would listen to this entire conversation and go, what are they talking about?
Right.
Because they're just, you know, people who get up in the morning and they just like do stuff, and that's just life.
And I don't know. I don't know what it is. I mean, there's a certain kind of introspective view of things that is present in people who have this, you know, particular area of interest. But I don't know that it's because of being introspective. It must be to a certain extent, because it's born of being aware of how it works.
It's a certain kind of introspection.
Well, there seems to be two. We know about the sort of like two sides of things, the contemplative side and the action-oriented side.
Yeah.
And there's this sort of two general groups of people. I think there are sort of two general groups that way.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I'm seeing it a little bit differently, because there are people who are very inner-oriented people, who are very spiritual people, but also tend to be action or, you know,
I've been attempting my entire life to strike a balance here, because I'm action-oriented and contemplative-oriented. So there must be it's like we've talked about in art, the person that's the expressionist with no structure and the person that has structure but no life in there, and so that a work of art is going to be too heavy on one side or the other, and a balanced, beautiful masterwork is the one where these things come into balance. And now we've extended this into performance, action, and life for all people. And I think that the contemplative person has to be able to be rooted in action, and the action person has to be rooted in some degree of this is what the idea behind meditation is all about, is because we've all a little bit too action-oriented in the world that we've been living in. We have had no platform to work from. I'm definitely, in some ways, I'm listening to both of you and thinking, oh yeah, both of these things are what I'm trying to, I think we all are, but I definitely, this is my quest. And especially what I've been doing in the last decade is that I got myself frozen, and I've been trying to figure out how to, while not letting go of this ultimate question of what it is and who it is, mm-hmm. and what's driving the it all and my action, being able to effortlessly and spontaneously and with joy just respond to what's in front of my face, because that's being delivered to me as the thing that needs to be done now.
It's kind of like a paradoxical goal, that once you know about it, the goal ultimately becomes one of being able to deliberately be spontaneous. And yet, in the knowledge that that's a complete contradiction in terms, and the deliberateness and spontaneity both end up disappearing, and the reality is neither. That's some sort of dialectic thing that's come out of thinking about it too much, or thinking about it just enough, or whatever. But it's really, you know, it's only a paradox because you try to fit it into some sort of conceptual framework. And the real lesson that underlies all of this is that no conceptual framework can do justice to reality.
Aha. Because conceptual frameworks are endless.
And they're finite.
Endless conceptual framework of the same thing. And perhaps I got a blessing at an early age in my early 20s when I was very close friends with someone who was probably the most abstract thinker I've ever met in my life, who could take anything and just like question it to death and take you here. And it was fascinating. It absolutely was fascinating, but it left me in the end feeling like, boy, you could wind up in a mouse hole for the rest of your life if this is your pattern of thinking.
Oh, well, I can tell you, I was one of those people. And I took everything apart because I thought if it couldn't stand up to my taking it apart, then it couldn't be all that, you know, long-lasting in value. And somewhere around the age of, you know, 15 or 16, I realized that was getting nowhere. That was not the thing to do. But I had this tendency born of language skills or something. I don't know where it comes from, but it's certainly connected with language skills. I had this tendency to do that anyway, to just get to the bottom of absolutely anything that comes up. And I've been, you know, kind of learning how not to do that for the rest of my life.
I think for me, my main motivator my whole life has been joy and enthusiasm and feeling alive, that my choices are often made simply by what of these opportunities available to me makes me feel the most joyful, the most alive, and the most capable of giving some kind of gift to other people along those lines and helping them feel more alive.
And I'm glad you never lost it, because what I did was squelch that in the name of something greater.
Yeah.
And I have had to have that thing force its way back in to say, wait. Life is this interface, this beautiful, lively, joyful interface between me and the other side, and so live it fully. But I wouldn't do that, and I'm learning finally how to just relax into that.
Go for it.
Just do it.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.